Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure being here. On the wall of his study in Berlin in the early 1920s, Einstein regarded Faraday and Maxwell as being responsible for the greatest revolution in our understanding of the physical world ever since the days of Newton. Newton's laws can tell you precisely the time of sunset and sunrise. It can enable you to compute the precise orbits of the planets, comets, and space vehicles. The stability of bridges and buildings go back to Newton's laws. The prediction of the ebb and flow of the tides on all the shores of all the oceans of the Earth can also be derived via Newton's laws. But Newton's laws will not help you one iota to understand the reception and transmission of radio waves. They will not enable you to work out how the telephone or the gramophone or the compact disc or the iPod or the iPhone works. To understand that, you go back step by step to the work of Michael Faraday, who was the first man to discover that every beam of light has a magnetic component and an electrical component. And if that were not so, you would not be able to have your wireless connection, and I would not be able to use this wireless device. So that is one of the main contributions that Faraday made. But there are so many others, which I'm going to tell you during the course of this lecture. Writing in the London Times in 1931, the date is significant, as you'll see in a moment, Lord Rutherford, who was arguably one of the greatest experimentalists of the 20th century, said, "The more we study the work of Michael Faraday with the perspective of time, the more impressed we are by his unrivaled genius as an experimenter and natural philosopher. When one considers the magnitude of the influence of his work on the evolution of science and technology, no honor is large enough to be paid to Michael Faraday, the greatest discoverer of all time." So you have, ladies and gentlemen, the greatest theoretical physicist and the greatest experimental physicist of the 20th century paying homage to this man who left school at the age of 13, equipped only with the rudiments of reading, writing, and arithmetic, who started as an apprentice for a bookbinder who delivered papers and books, and worked for 7 years as an apprentice till he was 21 in the center of London. Now, how is it that a man who knew no algebra, he certainly knew no calculus, made such an incredible contribution to science? How did it come about? Well, the story, I believe, is one of the most romantic in the history of science, because it tells you how an individual with a compelling, ineffable curiosity and an autodidact could conquer the world in a scientific sense. He started life as a very lowly assistant. But let me just, before explaining how he moved from that era of his career to be such a world figure in science, I just have to tell you that not only do we go back to Faraday to understand how the iPod and the mobile telephone works, there are so many other things that scientists feel indebted to him. Cosmologists recognize that it was Faraday who first talked about field theory, an electric field, a magnetic field, a gravitational field. Not only that, cosmologists recognize that it was Faraday who first started talking about the grand unification theory, the unifying concept which is still an enigma and still a chimera. Most of the cosmologists of the world are seeking kind of all the electricity that you get in most of the cities of the world goes back to electromagnetic induction. Even with nuclear power or hydroelectric power, what you're doing is capitalizing on the dynamo. The dynamo is a means whereby you convert mechanical action into electricity. And that was Faraday's perhaps greatest ever contribution. But he discovered and worked out the chemical formula of benzene. That in itself would have made him immortal in the annals of chemistry, because benzene is still of vital importance in the dyestuff industry, in the pharmaceutical industry, in fuels and so forth. He also discovered photochemistry of organic materials. When he was carrying out experiments in the Royal Institution, he noticed that even in the meager sunlight of London, it's enough to catalyze the conversion of benzene and chlorine to form a product, hexachlorobenzene. So these are some of the scientific achievements of the man. But in 1826, he initiated two educational programs which are still valid and still operating. One of them was to present a series of lectures to school children in London and its environment at Christmas time, the so-called Royal Institution Christmas Lectures, started in 1826 by Michael Faraday. And I shall talk about some of the experiments that he carried out in those exercises. Equally, he started popularizing science. Every Friday night in the autumn and in the winter in the Royal Institution at 9 p.m. precisely, a speaker walks in, no introduction, and he or she starts talking about earthquakes, about volcanoes, about climatology, whatever. He chose those speakers so as to communicate with the general public, and we still do that. So how did it come about that this man, Michael Faraday, of such lowly origin, at the age of 21, he was still working as a bookbinder. At the age of 34, he was a fellow of the Royal Society. At the age of 50, he was an honorary fellow of all the major academies of the world. And he was revered as a kindly, compassionate human being. He was a deeply religious man. Religion probably meant more to him than his science, startlingly. I find it very difficult to believe, but it seems to be true. The way he lived and his attendance at church and so forth, he belonged to a sect which has now died away, called the Sandemanian sect. It's of Quaker-like origin. They don't believe in organized religion. They speak among themselves. They help one another. They help the sick and the widowed and so forth. And he was exemplary as a member of that Sandemanian community. Well, where does it all begin? So I told you earlier, he was working in a bookshop. And in 1812, round about March the 1st, 1812, a kindly customer said to this bright-eyed young man, "Would you like to go and listen to arguably the brightest scientific star in the European firmament, Sir Humphry Davy, lecturing, giving his last four lectures as director of the Royal Institution?" "Of course," he said. And he went and he sat mesmerized, listening to this man, Sir Humphry Davy. Now, Davy was about 30 years of age at that time, and already he had discovered and identified sodium, potassium, calcium, strontium, barium, and iodine, and boron, sorry. He'd also found the anesthetic properties of nitrous oxide, and also he had discovered the carbon arc, which he used for illumination purposes. The streets of Paris, about 1850, had carbon arc for lighting. So this man combine felicity of literary expression with brilliant scientific discoveries. He was a friend of Wordsworth, of Coleridge, of Southey, of Walter Scott, and of Byron. He was the star of London, a brilliant lecturer, and an outstanding man of action, a brilliant conversationalist. Well, Faraday listened attentively to this man, mesmerized by what he saw and heard. He took copious notes. He rewrote them. He bound them. He indexed them. And he put in illustrations. And he took the liberty of writing to Humphry Davy, saying, "Can you offer me a job? I would like to become a scientist." And that is indeed what happened. Now, this is the Royal Institution, as it more or less now is. The traffic system is slightly different. But this is how it was. It's those of you who know London and know of Brown's Hotel in Albemarle Street. Albemarle Street, for other reasons, if there's question time, I can justify it as the most important street in London. Not because I lived there or because Faraday lived there, but there are other reasons. So he came and went to this place. Now, this is the book that Michael Faraday, in 1812, presented and sent to Humphry Davy with this letter of appeal. And in due course, Humphry Davy answered. It was on Christmas Eve, 1812. "Sir, I am far from being displeased with the proof that you have given me of your confidence and which displays great zeal, power of memory, and attention." And then he goes on to say, "Well, I'm going to be out of town for a while, but when I come back, I'll see you, and then we can talk it over." Now, I pause at this point, ladies and gentlemen. Only an Englishman could start this letter, "I am far from being displeased," right? The stiff upper lip Englishman, right? He receives a document of Mozartian perfection. And he doesn't jump with joy and says, "Oh, you are so clever," which is what a Welshman would say, or a Scot would say. No, "I am far from being displeased. Mr. Dean, I am extremely happy to be invited to come to Cairo to give these lectures. But if I were an Englishman, what I would say would be, I'm not sorry you invited me." Right? Now, within 6 weeks, Michael Faraday, who was a laboratory assistant, was preparing extremely capriciously explosive materials like nitrogen triiodide and nitrogen trichloride. And since Humphry Davy had married in March of 1812, he had decided, because Davy was the star of Europe, he'd won the Napoleon Prize, even though England and France were at war. But Napoleon was an extraordinary man, as every Egyptian knows, right? Napoleon had the generosity of spirit of giving him this prize. So what Davy did was to go in a stagecoach with his wife and Michael Faraday as an amanuensis. A very strange kind of honeymoon, you might say. And they traveled for 18 months. They went from Paris to Montpellier, to Genoa, to Como, to Turin, to Florence, and so on. They mingled with all sorts of savants in continental Europe. In Paris, they met Ampère and Gay-Lussac and Arago and various other people. And Faraday, being such an incredibly intelligent individual, learned French and Italian during the course of that 18-month tour, as well as having daily tutorials from Humphry Davy. That was his university, you see. So he comes back. They had to come back because the war situation had become pretty serious. And this now is the laboratory in 1813. Now, I might mention the Royal Institution, which is a basement laboratory in Mayfair in London, where all the diamond shops are. But if you look carefully, you find that there is this basement laboratory. And it was easily the best in Britain, possibly the best in the world, 60 years before the Clarendon Laboratory at Oxford or the Cavendish Laboratory at Cambridge were founded.
So it's remarkable.
And that's because of the incredible ability of Humphry Davy. I mean, Humphry Davy became president of the Royal Society. He founded the Geological Society. He founded the Zoological Society and the Mineralogical Society. He set up a men's club called the Athenaeum and made Faraday his secretary. He was an extraordinary man. Here is the laboratory that Michael Faraday used to do all his magnetic work. Now, at this point, I want to carry out one experiment just to remind you, and I will have to be dumb because I have to use two hands. I should have asked for a labeled microphone that would have helped me. But now let me tell you what the essence of electromagnetic induction is. He made this discovery on August the 29th, 1831, and electrical engineers the world over regard that as the starting point of the electrical industry, because electricity became freely available. And through the mechanism of converting mechanical action, as it were, or turbine action, via a magnet to generate electricity. So I shall have to be dumb, you know, and put this down, and I'll carry out this experiment. Is anybody willing to act as a commentator? Right. Here's a coil, and here's a magnet. What Faraday discovered was, watch this, right? You see? There's a kick when you make it, and another kick in the other way when you take it out, right? And the faster you put it in, the more of a kick there is, right? Now, Faraday thought out what this meant. He said, look, in every magnet there are lines of force joining up the poles. And what you're doing is, when you have a conducting wire intersecting those lines of force, you generate electricity. That's the basis of the generation of all the electricity centers throughout the world. Just a few fuel cells that generate 0.0001% of the electricity. So that is electromagnetic induction. I wish I could take that back with me, because I'm giving this lecture in Cambridge next Wednesday. Now, the other thing I want to draw to your attention very briefly is the experiment that he convinced himself demonstrated the existence of lines of force. You must have seen this performed at high school. A good teacher would sprinkle some iron filings on a thin cardboard, and you put a magnet underneath, and you play with it and you form these wonderful lines of force, you see. The number of lines of force, you see, Faraday worked out the theory in a febrile period of 6 weeks, the mechanism of electromagnetic induction. He knew no mathematics. Don't let anybody tell you that you have to be a superb mathematician in order to be a theorist. James Clerk Maxwell said, and he was one of the great mathematicians, that Faraday was a man who had a theory imbued throughout his body. His ideas would be generating mathematical activity for generations to come. So if you cut through those lines of force rapidly, you generate more quickly the electrical force. Now, this is an experiment which demonstrates that there is a significant difference between a solution and a colloidal dispersion. Now, why do I tell you that? Well, in 1857, he spent an enormous amount of time dealing with finely divided platinum, gold, silver, rhodium, many, many other metals, about 13 in all. And he demonstrated that by preparing them in a certain way, they could be suspended. This bottle containing colloidal platinum was prepared in February 1857, that particular bottle, right? It's still in a state of suspension. It doesn't, because it has a charge on it. Now, Faraday was smart enough, using narrow pencils of light. There was no laser. Laser wasn't discovered until 1961. But using a pencil of light, he concluded that there must be minute crystals, ever so minute. He was a nanoscientist, in other words, hundreds of years before nanoscience was invented as a term. And indeed, when my students in Cambridge prepared this in the same recipe as Faraday, we could see the individual platinum atoms. Now, to prove, you see, here's a magenta-colored sol. Here's another magenta-colored solution prepared by Professor Agai. This is permanganate. Now, look, see the difference? You see? You don't see the... Yeah. You see? So, the way to distinguish between a sol and a colloid is, and a solution is by that. Now, I'm going to just quickly summarize what he did, his principal contributions to chemical science. He started the subject of magnetochemistry. Now, what does that mean? Well, the fact that some materials are magnetic and others are not. Not just ferromagnetic like iron. He discovered that whereas nitrogen and hydrogen and carbon dioxide are repelled by a magnet, oxygen is attracted by a magnet. Oxygen is paramagnetic. He discovered that in 1845. We are to await 85 years until quantum mechanics came along before we could explain it. So he had spotted that oxygen was a very, very paramagnetic material. So was hemoglobin. But when he combined oxygen and hemoglobin to form oxyhemoglobin, it was diamagnetic. Nearly 100 years later, Linus Pauling explained that and brought forth his theory of chemical bonding. So that's his magnetochemistry, his electrochemistry, the electrical properties of matter. You see, throughout his life, electricity was the subject that he pondered deeply about. Its origins, its creation, its control, its application. What is it? And he contributed more than anyone else ever to understanding all those. The laws of electrolysis I've told you about. Superionic conductors, he was such a keen observer of what he carried out. He spotted that lead fluoride, when you heated it, unlike most other solids, became more conducting. That's known as superionic conductors. The fuel cells that you hear about these days are not feasible unless you have a superionic conductor there. That goes back to Faraday also. He studied catalysis. I'm not going to mention too much of that, but he observes very many fundamental things about it. The liquefaction of gases. See, up until Faraday's time, nobody really believed that every material, unless it's thermally unstable, can exist as a liquid, as a solid, and as a gas. The continuity of state. But, said Faraday, you take a gas, any gas, for a particular gas, no matter how high the pressure you compress it to, it will not liquefy unless you are below a certain temperature. It's called the critical temperature. Now, if he had done only that, his name would be immortal. But that was just one observation carried out in a period of 6 weeks, not long after he started working. Benzene. You know how he discovered benzene? His brother used to deliver gas cylinders to the Royal Institution for the London Gas Company, and he would use this gas. And he noticed that in giving back the empties to his brother Robert, there was a very aromatic smell. And it was a little liquid there, so he poured it out and he analyzed it, and that was benzene. It came from fish oil. When we analyzed the first sample of benzene, which is still in the Royal Institution, it's got less than 0.0001% sulfur, which tells you it doesn't come from petroleum. It comes from animal or fish origin. So that alone makes him extraordinary. Photochemical preparations, analytical chemistry. He could have become a very rich man. He was asked to analyze all sorts of things, clays, water, corrosion products, etc. And he was paid handsomely. But he felt, you know, that his religion, in part, didn't impel him to seek wealth and money. That was not the prime cause. He wanted to read the hand of God in what he observed and the word of God in what he read in the Bible. I'll come back to that later. He helped Davy with the evolution of the miner's safety lamp, but I don't have time to go into that. Here's his contributions to physical science. I've told you, the lines of force, unification of the forces of matter. In a paper that he wrote on the magnetization of light in 1845, and this is another feature of Faraday, he wrote with Chekhovian timelessness and beauty and charm. I have long held an opinion, amounting almost to conviction, in common, I believe, with other natural philosophers, that the various forms under which the forces of nature are made manifest have one common origin. Now, that's how he starts a paper. I look at all the professors here. How many papers have you seen written with such mellifluous charm and such incredible beauty? In fact, his beauty of writing is so good that to this day, his Chemical History of a Candle, and I'll come to that a little later, a book which is based on his Christmas lectures, is read by every Japanese boy or girl in their teens as long vacation study. It's in its 78th edition in Japanese, right? There's a secret there. Why are the Japanese so good, you know? I think we learned this. Dielectrics, electrostatics, the Faraday cage. He was such a dramatic man. He was a very shy man, reclusive almost. But Prince Albert adored him. And the great artists, you know, Charles Dickens, often. Charles Darwin, frequently. Charles Wheatstone invariably attended his lectures. In fact, George Eliot, the poet and writer, came and listened to him. So did Coleridge and many others. But he, when he talked about his science, was a showman. He wanted to demonstrate things in dramatic ways. How did he show to the audience that oxygen is paramagnetic? He blew bubbles of oxygen with a soap solution, and he blew bubbles of hydrogen, and he blew bubbles of nitrogen. And when the nitrogen and the hydrogen went through a pole piece, they went through unimpaired. But when he put oxygen, it got stuck. So it was paramagnetic, you see. And when people see that, I used to do a similar experiment. I used to pour liquid nitrogen and then liquid oxygen. And liquid oxygen forms a short circuit. It forms a rod of solid oxygen because it's paramagnetic. So it's wonderful. The other thing about the Faraday cage, he convinced himself the charge was on the outside. In the lecture theater of the Royal Institution, he built a cage 12 feet by 12 feet by 12 feet. He sat in a little stool inside. It was insulated from the earth. And he got his assistant to charge the cage to 150,000 volts. And there he was, without demur, inside, with the sparks flying in all directions from the outside. That's drama, you see. That he was a wonderful showman. And I will go on and skip that. Now, this is how he wrote up. That's his handwriting, August the 29th, 1831. He starts a new book. He wrote out every experiment as he went along. It's totally unique in the history of science, you know. There's something like 170,000 paragraphs describing why water melts, why ice melts, and why water freezes, and so on. And this one, experiments on the production of electricity from magnetism, have had an iron ring made, soft iron, here it is, and on he goes, and he takes a thick ring, 6 inches in diameter, etc., and he describes then how he winds a coil. Now, effectively, this is that experiment here. What he did was to have a coil around this ring here, and in this circuit here, he had a galvanometer. And what he found was that only when the current passed did you get a kick, And only when you stopped it did you get a kick in the other direction. That's transformer action. That is the first ever transformer. And we still have it in the Royal Institution, by the way. So it's a very dramatic thing. The laws of electrolysis, you see, they brought order where there was hitherto quite incredible chaos. And when you think carefully about it, and those of you who are physically, scientifically oriented, the fact that the chemical equivalent appears as a crucial factor in governing what happens in electrolysis tells you fundamentally that matter and electricity are inextricably mingled. So Feynman, one of the great physicists of America, Faraday discovered in 1832 that matter and electricity, you see, it, two disparate fields, matter on the one hand, which had exercised the thoughts of the ancient Egyptians and the Greeks and so forth, and then electricity, a new phenomenon, the star, what Franklin and others observed, but they're related, one and the other. The forces of matter are electrical. That's an incredible advance. Now, electroplating started in Birmingham as an industry in 1851. There was the Faraday electromagnetic device for generating electricity. They used it to electroplate silver onto copper. Within 5 years, the antique industry of antique silver in Sheffield gradually died, because now it was much cheaper. What they did in Sheffield was to take a plate of copper, put a thin film of silver on it, and beat it like mad until it formed a kind of coherent bond. Beautiful pieces of Sheffield silver. They're very expensive now because they're no longer produced. But overnight, almost, Birmingham took the ascendancy. It's the first ever electroplating shops in the world. There was a place in St. Petersburg in Russia where Jacobi carried out similar work. Just to show how prodigiously hard Faraday worked, and this always daunts me when I look at his career. From January 1832 to 1834, he published 20 original papers, and each one of those is a gem. He delivered 17 Friday evening discourses on magnetism, on lithography, on photography, and so on. Gave 6 Christmas lectures and 48 daytime lectures at the Royal Institution on a range of, delivered 75 lectures at the Military Academy in Woolwich, and had extensive correspondence with Ampere, Babbage, Berzelius, Mary Somerville, Plato, Herschel, Whewell, and wrote a 7,500-word memorandum to Gay-Lussac. At the same time, he was now becoming so much in demand in Britain, the National Gallery wanted his opinion on how to preserve and conserve paintings. The British Museum wanted to know how to restore and keep in good shape the Elgin marbles and so on. So he was in much demand. Now, Abdus Salam was the first ever Muslim Nobel Prize winner in science. He got it because of his work in the fundamental forces of the nucleus. And when he gave his Friday evening discourse at the Royal Institution, he showed this cartoon. First attempt to unify electricity and gravity. You see, here are these big balls that he's dropping down through a magnetic, a gravitational field. He's got a galvanometer, and he's got a cushion, and this is the coil, and there's a string, and there's Michael Faraday, right? He was convinced. He spent 2 years thinking that there was a connection between electricity and gravity, just as there is between magnetism and gravity. He wrote a 75-word article in Philosophical Transactions, and it ends in the most magnificent way. It says, "Here end my trials for the present. The results are negative, but they do not shake my conviction that there is a link between gravity and electricity. And that is still being pursued. So it's marvelous. So Abdus Salam gave that lecture. Now, he was an environmentalist as well. He complained in the London Times about the terrible pollution in the River Thames. Here he is giving the 1856 Christmas lectures in the Royal Institution. Here's Prince Albert with the two young princes either side of him. Here's this bald-headed gentleman, mainly their students, but he was the devoted Charles Wheatstone. Those of you who know Wheatstone's bridge, right? Now, Wheatstone was a brilliant man. He started life as a musician, and he built many musical instruments, including the concertina. And he was very, very good in stereo vision. He was a tremendous instrumentalist, but he was an incorrigibly nervous man. And when Faraday convinced him to give a Friday evening discourse, what happens is that the director, Faraday, and his wife would give a dinner beforehand, and half an hour before the lecture is due to begin, the director takes the speaker into a quiet room, and I'm glad that Rania Borai did a quiet room effort for me here, right? So then, at 9:05, Faraday appears and takes the speaker into the lecture theater. On that occasion, Charles Wheatstone was so nervous, he ran home. So Faraday had to give a lecture. And ever since, we lock the door, right? You see? It's a new meaning to Faraday cage, you see. Right? So now, here is Faraday giving, and this, I regard this as one of the most beautiful and charming pieces of writing in the English language. You know, the candle, the chemical history of the candle. You must remember that in 1840, when he first gave this lecture, he gave it again in 1860, the candle was the high-tech device of the age. You know, you didn't have electricity, an electric light. What it did to transform civilized life, people could speak to one another at night, and they had luminosity, and no, you know, very little other disturbance, a silent flame, a marvelous contribution. Well, Sir William Crookes, a fabulous scientist himself, and a great admirer of Faraday, said this, in the preface, from the primitive pine torch to the paraffin candle, how wide an interval between them, how vast a contrast. The means adopted by man to illuminate his home at night stamp at once his position in the scale of civilization. The fluid bitumen of the Far East, blazing in rude vessels of baked earth, the Etruscan lamp, exquisite in form, yet ill adapted to its office, the whale, seal, or bear fat, filling the hut of the Eskimo or Lapp with odor rather than light, the huge wax candle on the glittering altar, the range of gas lamps in our streets, all have their stories to tell. All, if they could speak, and after their own manner, they can, might warm our hearts in telling how they have ministered to man's comfort, love of home, toil and devotion. It's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. Now, here are just a few of the Friday evening discourses that Michael Faraday gave. He lectured about 1,200 times in his period. He was director for nearly 50 years. Here are some, and the attendance figures are given, right? His speculations touching electrical conductions and the nature of matter, right? And static printing, the artesian well and water, magnetism and light, a very popular one. There's an important lesson in this. If you want a large audience, choose a small title. Look, you see, there were only 357 who came to. Two ladies here with whom he interacted. He was, by the way, blissfully, happily married to Sarah Barnard, who was also a Sandemanian. They had no children, but they were deeply devoted to one another. He had many nephews and nieces, and he looked after them, and he looked after her. She was non-intellectual. She would say that she was the pillow of his mind. It was a very lovely statement. Anyway, here's Mary Somerville. Now, Mary Somerville was a formidable mathematician, widowed twice, by the way, and six children in all, But she translated Laplace's discourse on probability and celestial mechanics into English. She was a very formidable geographer. And in fact, Somerville College in Oxford is named after her. Now, that's one lady. She adored Faraday. Once she discovered him, she used to show up at Friday evening discourses and write to him. Of course, everybody wanted to write to him. And Faraday was such a devoted scientist and such an honest man. He always answered people. In one letter, March the 1st, 1834, he wrote to Mary Somerville, "I no longer can deny myself the pleasure of answering your letter of so-and-so." Isn't that a beautiful way to start a letter? "I no longer can deny myself the pleasure of answering your letter." Now, Ada, Countess of Lovelace, she was the daughter of Lord Byron. She never saw Lord Byron. Byron, as you know, was a brilliant poet, a considerable philosopher, but he was an absolute rascal of a human being. I wouldn't wish to spend any time in his company. And he was licentious and lecherous and all sorts of other things. And his wife, the mother of this lady, Ada, the Countess of Lovelace, because she married a duke, she abandoned Byron very quickly. But Aunt Ada was a brilliant mathematician. In fact, she was so good in the notion of what computing could do that she is universally recognized as the first ever computer programmer. In fact, when the US military in the late 40s devised a new computer language, they called it Ada in her memory. She was way beyond what Charles Babbage, the man who designed the first computer, could do. He was just interested in number crunching. She was interested in concepts. She was a brilliant lady. She was married, she had three children. She died of uterine cancer at the age of 36. But from the age of about 30 onwards, she became infatuated with Michael Faraday. She wrote to him so frequently, she would suggest that he would repeat all his experiments in her presence. Now, can you imagine, you know? How do you answer a letter like that, right? And she wanted, as she said, to be his bride in science, which has all sorts of overtones. So these are just the two ladies that he fraternized with. Now, he read the Bible devotedly, not just every Sunday, but every day. And he had, as in everything, he was a meticulous man who had a system, who recorded everything, and who had a method of recording. These are the symbols that he used against the various verses in the Bible, and they signify which are the most important, the less important, and not so important, and the not necessarily the least important. And this is his Bible. And his favorite verse, you see, is in the book of Job. "If I justify myself, my own mouth shall condemn me. If I say I am perfect, it shall also make me perverse." Now, what that means to him and every subsequent interpreter is you should be severe in your own criticism of your own action and should, contrariwise, be generous to others. And that's really the principle on which he worked. Jane Austen, in one of her letters, and I'm sure Faraday would have agreed with this, she wrote it about 10 years before he was active in this work. "Teach us, O God, to think humbly of ourselves, to be severe only in the examination of our own conduct, to think kindly of our fellow creatures." It's a beautiful statement. Jane Austen writing a letter to a friend, and that epitomizes the mentality and the generosity and the decency, the singular kindness of heart that Michael Faraday exhibited. When I lived in the Royal Institution, my wife would go to bed before me, I'd work late at night, I'd go to the bathroom, wash my hands, clean my teeth and so forth, and I would always feel depressed because the bathroom furniture was built by Michael Faraday. And on it was this M. Faraday, it made me think, have you worked hard enough? Should you go back? Should you know? It was almost demoralizing, but also inspiring. Now, here is a Friday evening discourse in 1904, and it's by my predecessor and Faraday's successor, Sir James Dewar, demonstrating the liquefaction of hydrogen in his Dewar flask, the thermos flask, invented in the Royal Institution by Dewar. Think of all the things that have started from there: sodium, potassium, calcium, electromagnetic induction, no question about it. It's one of the world centers of creativity, right? Now, let me tell you who was there. Oliver Lodge, who himself was really a smart man in transmission and reception of radio. Oliver Lodge, the principal of Birmingham University. Ludwig Mond, a very enlightened, philanthropic German Jew who started ICI. This is George Matte of Janssen Matte fame. Faraday got all his platinum from George Matte. This is Lord Rayleigh, first ever Nobel Prize winner to come to Britain. This is Sir James Crichton Browne, the Queen's physician. This is Sir William Crookes, the man who wrote that beautiful preface. This is the Prime Minister, A.J. Balfour. This is George Gabriel Stokes, whom you mentioned, Mr. Chairman. This is Lord Lister. And here, the 84-year-old Lord Kelvin. And over here, just about visible, the 30-year-old Italian named Marconi. So this is quite an event. If that liquid hydrogen had exploded that evening, what the intellectual life of Britain would have been as a consequence is difficult to assess. One of the things I'm very proud of was that I convinced the Bank of England that on the bicentenary of the birth of Faraday, we should replace even William Shakespeare, whom I admire beyond words, whose picture was on the £20 note, by Michael Faraday. And this is it, and here is Faraday lecturing, you see, here he is again. Now, let me just tell you, he's pointing up towards this roster of names. Electrode is anode, iron, cathode, anion, electrolyte, electrolysis. All those words were coined by Michael Faraday. So he contributes to the lexicon of the English language, not just the knowledge of the physical world. Lines of force on a £20 magnet, a pound note. You know, not many people noticed it, mind you, but there we are. And here's Michael Faraday. I wrote a book on him in 1991, The Genius of Man and Place. There he is, at the age of 40. You know, there are several things one should say about Faraday. I'm going to read out to you my summing up, if you don't mind. Before I read my summary, let me just point out to you how noble a gentleman Faraday was, how decent and kind he was, and how exemplary he was in his attention to children. When he ended his Christmas lectures on the candle, what he did in the last lecture was to explain that as we live, we breathe, we burn fat. It's like the burning of a candle. Respiration and the burning of a candle are chemically identical. Thus you see the analogy between respiration and combustion. All I can say to you at the end of these lectures is to express a wish that you may in your generation be fit to compare to a candle, that you may like it shine as lights to those about you, that in all your actions you may justify the beauty of the taper by making your deeds honorable and effective in the discharge of your duty to your fellow men. Beautiful, you see. There's almost a religious zeal there. So now here's my summing up. Because people ask me, you know, well, what do you say? How do we have such an incredible human being? Well, there's several things. He has unquenchable curiosity, an ineffable, compelling need to understand things. And once he works on understanding, he believes in the dictum, work finish, publish. A passion for clarity in the conception of an experiment, in the execution of an experiment, in writing it up, and in illustrating it to the general public. To all the questions that he asked, he believed there was an answer. Experiment is the servant of the imagination, he used to say. The best test of any concept is experiment. His choice of problems was astute. He raised important, big questions. What governs electrolysis? How does electricity come from magnetism? His tactics and strategy in answering these questions were impeccable. The economy and eloquence of his experimental investigations were extraordinary. He devised the best possible equipment, best possible instruments and materials to use in his experiments. His coulometer was the most sensitive in the world. His electromagnet was the most powerful. He built it himself. His glass specimens were of superior quality and heavier than those of his contemporaries. He demonstrated his discoveries and those of others in memorable, dramatic ways. Think of the oxygen bubble. Think of the Faraday cage. Even the format of a Friday evening discourse was perfect. You just walk in, you give your lecture, and you walk out. He combined in a supreme way technical virtuosity, intuition, manipulative dexterity, as well as being morally incorruptible. Thank you very much.